From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the first of two discussions about military history. What's the nature of military history? How do military historians, classical and contemporary, make sense of their subjects? To what extent do military historians offer theories of history that go beyond chronicles of warfare? The panelists in the following portion of the conversation are three military historians, Samuel Williamson, Douglas Porch, and James Lutze. Sam Williamson and Douglas Porch recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Professor Williamson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he also serves as Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Douglas Porch is a professor at The Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. James Lutze is chairman of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Sam Williamson.
There's a need to clarify what we mean by military historians. There are at least a series of groups of people who practice military history. There are the professional academic historians, such as those participating in this program, who would seek to look at all the records and then reach some conclusions, which may in some cases even be sweeping generalizations at some point. There then is another group of military historians who are professional military historians and often are professional military men and women working for the government writing official histories, which often tend to be chronicles but become the repository for information and data which the policymakers can draw upon to learn the lessons of history. And then there is what you might call the popular journalist, military historian, the person who immerses himself in a set of material and then writes a fairly popular book. And in those, you may often have sweeping dicta about the lessons of history. But those are the kinds of sort of broad distinctions I think we have to keep in mind as we proceed in our discussion, because the military historians employed by the military do a very valuable service. They have enormous amounts of data readily at hand. It is reasonably accurate in terms of statistical comparison, short sometimes on analysis and short sometimes on motivation.
How do the policymakers figure out what kind of military history to read?
Well, let me respond to that. Wayne, I think, first of all, it would be presumptuous to believe that many senior-level policymakers, like many undergraduates, read as much as they are asked to read or should read. And in that sense, one has to wonder who is doing the distilling for them.
You're speaking there as a dean as well as a writer of military history.
As a professional educator. But the question of what the very senior policymakers read is always going to be very much at the margin, because they're very harried individuals with limited amounts of time. The more important thing is what the people who are advising them are reading and how much time do they have to read. I think it is a singular kind of incident when somebody like John Kennedy can say that he had read the works of Sir Basil Little Hart and Barbara Tuchman, and that particularly the work of Barbara Tuchman about the Guns of August may have influenced the way he looked at the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think those times when policymakers sat back and had a chance to read are probably much fewer. Certainly the British statesmen, the British generals, the British leaders in the 19th and 20th century were intimately familiar with the works of Thucydides, Herodotus, Caesar, and they had at their disposal a whole repertoire of information about past military campaigns. Highly unlikely that many senior policymakers will have read very deeply into history or any kind of history, much less military history. So we have to, and that's why the professional military historians who are asked to prepare briefing papers, or people in the State Department in the historical section, are tremendously important, because they are trying to distill in a fairly shorthand form the lessons of history for the senior policymakers. And therein lies a danger, because the minute you begin to simplify and to put into sort of one numbered paragraph after another, you have begun to distort the complexity and the interconnection of the historical process. And it's very easy then to get the Munich lesson, or another, don't have another loss of China, or you can't have another fall of Cuba. These sort of shorthand symbols didn't come to have a whole set of belief structures attached to them, which may or may not rest upon any kind of solid underpinning.
How does military history now differ from well, say, what was being done 100 years ago. Or let's talk in very broad terms. Sam Williamson mentioned Thucydides. How would you characterize the evolution of military history?
Well, military history in the past has been largely campaign history. It has been stunted because it has not really been accepted as a viable academic subject by the universities. This is quite understandable. Universities, with their long humanist tradition, I think tend, for the best possible reasons, to want to close their eyes to the aspects of human nature, that perhaps human nature is not perfectible, that war or conflict is a normal way of settling human crises. That military historians want to examine war and the organizations that fight those wars doesn't necessarily mean that we condone these sort of things. On the contrary, we would argue that by understanding how these organizations work, by understanding how wars come about, we can perhaps better hope to understand and possibly to prevent them, or at least through an understanding, bring a greater awareness of the policymakers and others to the prevention and the conduct of war. So military history has largely been rejected by the universities and therefore has remained for many years stunted and confined to a ghetto of campaign histories. In many respects, the soldiers themselves are responsible for this because they wanted to see military history as a way of pointing up the heroic qualities of the race. Von Moltke believed that the histories of the German army should show what marvelous chaps Germans were and how they fitted into an image of Teutonic manhood. So I think a combination of the soldiers and the humanist, in fact, have meant that military has meant in the past that military history has remained rather stunted. I think it was really with the Great War, the First World War, and the Second World War that people began to realize the enormous political and social implications, and indeed technical implications of war, that we simply can't say, well, soldiers fight the wars, we get up to the war, and then we leave it alone, and then we just let the soldiers fight it. In other words, there's got to be some sort of understanding of how not only military organizations function, but understanding, as Sam was saying, of strategy and politics, understanding of military organizations as social entities, of military men as professionals, what prejudices they bring to their profession, how are they recruited, etc. So military history then expands to include not only the traditional campaign histories, they also expand to include things like Sam Williamson is doing, that old-style diplomatic history has not only said that we diplomats, the job of the diplomat is to prevent war from happening. On the contrary, the job of the diplomat may be to bring about a war, but they have to know that war is fought on the best possible terms for their particular country, and that once war begins, diplomacy doesn't cease. So diplomatic history is now called international history because it has to take into consideration problems of strategy in military organizations. Also, we have to look at how an army functions in peacetime. And this, I think, has been a noticeable shift in military history, away from what an army does actually in battle to what an army does in times of peace, because it's how the organization functions in times of peace. It is how an organization is seen by a society, which will largely depend on how that organization fights when, as the soldiers would say, the balloon actually goes up. So you can't really, as many people are trying to do, simply explain the fall of France in 1940 on a series of bad tactical choices. That war was lost perhaps as early as 1918.
What are the, Doug has ticked off some of them, how armies behave in peacetime and how bureaucracies get arranged. What are the major elements that you look for as you try to bring all these things together and call it military history? Why should anybody read, for instance, Caesar on his wars, that sort of thing?
Well, without making the case for classical history seem excessive, Thucydides' history of the Greek Wars remains a classic primer on the nature of diplomacy, the nature of deception, the nature of the need for popular support, and the problem of what happens to the societies involved in a prolonged war, so that over time Athens became more and more like Sparta. And in that sense, it offers a very cautionary note about the long nature of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States, when you have total societies, and those were small societies to be sure, locked in what they regard as mortal combat, whether in actual physical combat or sort of a Cold War situation. You have some very interesting things that emerge, and Thucydides is hard to improve upon. Caesar, by contrast, is a military commander, obviously gifted as a writer, who talks about, in the nature of the conquest of Gaul, a variety of issues which involve the relationship between civil and military power and the nature of support at home and the use of military forces in the field. What happens is, in the intervening period between Thucydides and Caesar, is a long period of chronicles, of which the Crusades and so in the Middle Ages, the sort of one chronicle after another, so that what you do get is almost nothing but sort of how many foot soldiers were here and how many arrows were there, and no attempt to integrate, and sort of a chivalric notion coming out of this, so in an age in which warfare seem to have little purpose. So, I mean, I would not exaggerate what the classics have to say, but I think in some sense an appreciation that human experience is not always novel is very useful, and that's what the historian is trying to sort of say to the policymaker. And in that sense, Caesar or Thucydides is saying something which really is timeless in some sense of the categories of problem.
Apart then from the fact that there's nothing really new in human nature that the military historians would look at. How has the writing of military history changed? I would take it that it's really speeded up in the last couple of hundred years.
Let me come back, though, Wayne, and sort of nothing new in human experience, but there are things that are new in terms of human institutions. Mm-hmm. And the development of the bureaucracy and the bureaucratic state, which is a phenomenon of late 19th century European and then American society, and with it coming then the emerging military bureaucracies and naval. And I think our listeners should understand that at all points we're talking about military in the broadest sense, to include naval, air force, and all kinds of military forces. I think that emergence of the bureaucratic state has posed and does pose particular problems, which Caesar or Thucydides did not address. We're talking about now how you deal with great monolithic, faceless organizations, which develop career patterns and, as Doug has mentioned earlier, have a virtual autonomy of their own, almost uncontrolled and uncontrollable. The best example, obviously, is can one person control the Department of Defense? And the answer to that question is, as a popular study recently in a magazine called International Security suggested, is it really doesn't make any difference who the Secretary of Defense is on a lot of issues. He or she is not going to be able to have much influence on that deep moving sea called the Pentagon. Sometimes not moving so deep or so swift, but secretaries of defense will come and go in the Pentagon like deans coming and going in departments remaining forever.
A fascinating question that it seems to me to be integral to the whole history of democracy, whether you call it military history or not, is the question of the place of the military in a democratic society. I mean, this is something that has been at the baseline of the growth. I can trace it from the growth of the British parliamentary system right on up to the present. And although the military has changed and evolved, King John negotiating with his barons and trying to decide who was going to be in control here and who was going to control the military function in Parliament, and the king arguing over the power of the purse and the ability to wage war and so on, and how that was going to fit into the society, you can follow that right up to the budget debates of today and in determining what role the military is going to have.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first of two discussions about military history. The panelists are three military historians, James Lutze, Sam Williamson, and Douglas Porch. James Lutze is chairman of the curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Douglas Porch is a professor at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. Sam Williamson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he also serves as dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Professors Porch and Williamson recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Douglas Porch worked on a book about the French colonial army in the 19th and 20th centuries. Sam Williamson's research focused on Austria and Hungary and the War of 1914. Here is Sam Williamson.
Pick up on Jim's problem about the democratic society. One of the concepts that you go all the way back again to link classical antiquity with the present is the concept of and duties of citizenship. What is the role of the citizen? And Doug has alluded to the fact that there were paramilitary societies in this whole period, particularly of the of coming out of the medieval society, in which military virtue was widely shared, and there was a whole sort of codes that went with it. And one of the things that modern society, in particular democratic society in the West, has to deal with is the question of what the citizen's relationship, just the average citizen's relationship, is to the military service. We have opted in this country for an all-volunteer force. There are a fair number of people, I happen to be one of them, who think that was a classic mistake of learning the wrong lesson from the Vietnam War. And that, in a sense, one has the danger of isolating the military institutions over time from the rest of society, and that isolation, which increases an already autonomous base, could lead over the longer period of time to things that the society as a whole may be very uncomfortable with.
Well, let's talk about that very broad abstract notion of citizenship, for instance. A lot of what you have been talking about, you have implied certain social values. We did a discussion on Soundings recently about notions of tragedy in Western drama and literature. And part of the discussion focused on what people will die for, what motivates people to commit murder. For instance, the notion of honor, the notion of duty to the state, the notion of duty to oneself. My question that I'm coming to is how much do military historians take into account to what extent do you take into account these very broad social abstractions such as duty and honor and citizenship? They're important, I can see that. But can you give me a for instance in the way a military historian has looked at a situation? Doug, they're all pointing at you. You might want to talk about
this
book you've done.
Well, I can only talk on a very, well, what Jim would say, the lowest level of military history. But certainly there has been some research done, which unfortunately has been ignored by the American policymakers in any case, about what actually motivates men in battle. And it's not patriotism, it's not the flag, it's not mom and apple pie, it's not wanting to let down your buddies. That's what makes them stand and fight in the end. They don't want to be embarrassed, they don't want to be ashamed.
So it's honor. You're calling it?
Okay, personal honor, if that's what you'd like to call it. And it's something that the more traditional armies, like the British Army, have recognized for a long time, that it's social homogeneity within the unit which counts. The German, one of the reasons that the Wehrmacht was always so successful is they did create a very successful homogeneous army or part or regiments, locally recruited, very paternalistic in their discipline, which helped them to continue to fight very well.
Democracies, someone has suggested, democracies only fight crusades. People have to be motivated that they are doing something of transcendent value in order to get people to fight in a democratic society.
Why is that? Because democratic societies assume that the primary interest is self-interest, is a personal interest that exists at the individual level.
To a certain extent, that's true, but there's a practical aspect involved. That is, theoretically, democratic wars are only fought at when the will of the public wants them to be fought. You do not force a democratic society to fight a war. Therefore, you have to motivate a broad level of people to participate in this. I think the question that I'm inherently coming to is, given the current nature of American society, in which we tend to, you see bumper stickers that say question authority, one wonders if you are going to be able to convince people again that they are fighting a crusade. President Reagan, I think, has largely drawn negative comment from suggestions that he has made that the United States is fighting evil and that the Soviets are evil, and trying to elicit, I suppose, a kind of a crusading atmosphere in this regard. And I wonder how successfully a democratic society is going to be motivated in the future if it only fights crusades. And we can, that may not be in a commonly or totally acceptable idea, but if we only fight crusades, are there any crusades left that people are really going to believe in, or has the belief structure been so eroded by World War One, Vietnam, Korea, and so on, that people will no longer be able to, in a democratic society, no longer be able to be convinced that they ought to fight? The lessons that I draw, or the things that I look at, fall into very broad categories. For instance, I'm convinced that Americans do not have, and policymakers have not regarded war broadly enough, that we tend to separate war diplomacy and other things into separate little categories instead of seeing the connections between these things. And if there's a kind of a general thrust to my work, that is the thrust that I would highlight, is that we Americans have rejected the Clausewitzian notion that war is an extension of state politics by other means. Americans don't accept that. We put war into a separate category, and wars begin and wars end, and then real life goes on. Wars are an anomaly, not a normal sort of thing. And so that's the kind of a broad thing that I am interested in, and I would hope that people would accept that, but if they don't accept it, it wouldn't surprise me particularly.
Well, you say that Americans think that way. In contrast to what, Europeans, Chinese?
I think the Soviets very clearly accept the idea that war is an extension of state politics by other means.
And not only an extension of state politics, but a natural state of affairs?
I would say more than Americans do. I think, and we can argue about this, I think Americans have a romantic, unrealistic idea of war. And until fairly recently, actually, Americans, I think, had a romantic, unrealistic view of what went on the battlefield.
Even with the television bringing this stuff.
As I say, until fairly recently, that was the difference. I mean, realize that in World War II, I think the first picture of someone dead on the field was not published until 1943, so that throughout 1942 and part of 43, the image was projected that this war was going on without anybody actually getting killed here, and so that Americans have, whereas I don't think the French had that view, and I don't think the British had that view, and I don't think the Germans had that view, or the Austrians had that view. They had a better gut level feeling for what went on. But Americans, in this whole context of a crusading atmosphere and so on, of whatever it might happen, whichever the war might have happened to be, if they were, they didn't think of it in realistic terms.
Jim, I won't take issue directly, but let me suggest that probably the experience of in the South in particular, but after the Civil War, would suggest that they had that intimate connection with warfare and knew some of the horrors in the intimate sense, partly in those areas in which the battles had themselves been taking place, and certainly around Gettysburg and other places where they saw firsthand. You know, they weren't the pictures in the sense of photographs. You had engravings and stuff, and you may be right, but in the sense that I would argue that in the immediate post-Civil War period, they had that intimacy. The ironic part of it was, of course, the Cuban, what Teddy Roosevelt called the splendid little war against Cuba and the Philippines in the First World War and the Second World War were all fought very far away from home, and even Pearl Harbor was a long way away from home. So you didn't have that sense of intimacy, which then would be the photographs, and then now subsequently, obviously, television has made so much the question for the living room.
Interesting. I'm doing some work on the Civil War right now in this regard, and actually the things that that the veterans that wrote about the war, I mean Civil War veterans like Longstreet or D.H. Hill or whatever, who wrote about the war, that war was, you wouldn't recognize that war, the war that they wrote about, the war of riding grandly over the hills with their banners flying and the swords flashing and all these things. You don't read about people dying or bleeding, and you don't read about the terrible medical care, and you don't read about the sickness and illness in the camps and that sort of thing. And it almost became noble to have lost, and it's a peculiar kind of thing of how they looked at the war, and to my mind that helps explain how Americans marched off to World War I with the banners flying and rejected the evidence that was there of how terrible that first, those 4 years of war that we had not participated in, or 3 years of war that we had not participated in, was.
Well, I think we all agreed that the wrong side won in the Civil War. But it, couldn't you not extend this? You talk about the South romanticizing their defeat. Is it not possible that in an age of nationalism, any defeated side will romanticize their defeat? Look at the Germans after the 1418 war. Mm-hmm. They were the only people who were willing to go to war, who were psychologically prepared for it in 1939.
Why do you think that was? You know, that has always fascinated me. I've been to Verdun, and I've taken student groups there, and you can go to Verdun, you can see where 500,000 French casualties and an almost equal number of German casualties occurred. And it's very easy to draw the conclusion that, as you say, you can't explain the tactical defeats of 1940. You have to go back to 1918 or so. I would say you could go back, in the case of France, to 1916 and say that the spirit of France died on the field at Verdun in 1916 in that battle. But why do the Germans are there too? They lose almost equal numbers. Is it because of this romanticization of the defeat, or the sublimation of the defeat, that makes them want revanche here?
Well, maybe what is defeat and what is victory has become inverted in modern times. I mean, we've always, looking at the Vietnam War, become increasingly obvious that in military terms, if there is such a thing, that the Americans did far better than people thought they did. But it's not who is actually who kills the most soldiers, it's who's actually occupying the field in the end, and it was a psychological victory mm-hmm. in the long run. Now, is it not perhaps fair to argue as well that although in 1918 the French won, militarily, mm-hmm. they suffered a psychological defeat.
But Doug, I think you hit the nub up by saying that how you define defeat and victory. Did the Germans actually think they had been defeated in the military sense in 1918? And the answer to that question is probably no.
That's right. And the stab in the back, mm-hmm. the whole myth, the deification of Ludendorff, or whatever. So in many respects, I think we have to re-examine our traditional notions in the light of modern guerrilla warfare. I think it's brought to a lot of things, as by reading Mao and people like this, we find that what he considers victory and what a traditional general would consider victory are something entirely different.
Well, the policymakers, which is where we began the discussion initially about drawing lessons from history, certainly in the Second World War, concluded that the Germans had not felt the pain of defeat, and they were going to be very determined. And the weapons of modern warfare with air power made it clear that they were suffering in their cities and the bombs. But not only did they want to make sure, they were going to crush all the units and then have an occupation which would leave no doubt that there was a defeat. And that was clearly harking back to an earlier notion. That a simple occupation of the Rhineland was not going to be enough.
And that the Versailles Treaty was not, in fact, harsh enough.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the first of two discussions about military history. The panelists were Douglas Porch of the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina, and Sam Williamson and James Lutze of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Next week on Soundings, part two of the discussion about military history with Professors Lutze, Porch, and Williamson. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the first of two discussions about military history. In part one of Patterns Called War, a panel of three military historians from the University of North Carolina and from the Citadel will discuss the nature of military history. How do military historians, classical and contemporary, make sense of their subjects? To what extent do military historians offer theories of history that go beyond chronicles of warfare? That's Patterns Called War, the first of two discussions this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.